And it looks like we are once again building a recording. Better a little late than never, right?
Well, we've been really good about this. So I don't think any of our listeners can certainly complain that we've been generally speaking on time and under budget. And I'm sure September will be no different. Mike, welcome to the September Mike and Scotty show.
Yes.
And we really haven't talked since the last podcast, which is a little unusual. We usually catch up at some point during the month.
I think we have both had, by any reasonable definition, a hell of a month.
Well, and looking back at it, I'd go as far as to say, I've been on my toes since April, and August is has been kind of the culmination of that, as it was brought to my attention by my loving girlfriend, who we were just kind of looking back at the year so far. But my August was straight out between work and trips and so on and so forth. And Micah, evidently by the preface, yours was too. So I'll let you kind of jump into this.
Yeah, well, I think on the last podcast I spoke about the fact that I was remodeling or expanding my tractor shed. And I was basically adding another third to it. It was a 14-foot long building, and I was adding 7 feet to it. And I don't know if we had poured the concrete already by that time, but basically I built all the forms and had a couple of guys come in and do the concrete, and boy, was I glad that I did, because when that truck starts disgorging massive amounts of concrete, if it's just you looking at that, you just want to run for the hills, you know what I mean? So it was great to be able to have somebody that knew what they were doing, that just kind of took care of it, and they did a great job. So that worked out great. And then as soon as the concrete was done in a couple of days, I was ready to start building the addition, and I did. And I amazed a couple of my friends by putting up all of the walls and in no time at all. And then it's ground level stuff, so it wasn't that bad really. If you know carpentry, you just do it. But once I got to building the roof, that was considerably harder because it's a roof. And you're not just building a roof, you're trying to match an existing roof that isn't exactly all the right angles. So that was, and you're doing it by yourself, and everything's easier when you have an extra pair of hands. But at this time of year, I don't have my faithful buddy down in the Cape to help me. So the choice was do it myself or wait until November, and I didn't think that was a good option. So I did it myself. I wanted to be done with it, And as luck would have it, like any project, you get into the project and unexpected things happen. That's the life of the project manager that I know a
Sure.
little bit about. And it's funny how it just never fails. It's like the only thing you can count on is that you can't count on anything. So you take your best shot at it, you plan as best you can, and then you prepare to deal with what comes up. In my case, once I was getting ready to start winding down the project, part of what I was going to do was put a piece of pressure treated along the right-hand side of the shed. And when I took the shingles off to do that, the entire bottom of the wall and the beam was completely rotted out. Like
Of course it was.
you could just reach your hand in and crumble it, with no effort.
Yep.
So I looked at that and thought, that is not in the project plan. But what I had to do was find a way to prop up the wall, chop off the bottom foot of the wall, put a new piece of pressure treated at the bottom of that, basically do. I think I bought, I don't know if it was 36 bags of concrete,
Wow.
because I had to make a new foundation in that spot, in place. So to say that it took more than 5 minutes to do that would be an understatement, So the bottom line is, I worked the entire month of August, every day that it wasn't raining, all day until it was dark, to get it done. And just today at 6:45, when I called you and said, let's do it a half an hour later, that's when I finished.
Wow.
And at the same time, I've been helping my wife with the mulch pile from hell, and that's been mocking us sitting there since May. And
Really?
it seemed like no matter how much mulch we took out of that pile, it still looked like the size of a Volkswagen Beetle.
How
So
many yards?
it was a whole dump truck full, and I don't remember how many yards that was. But it's not just like you take the mulch and you just spread it out. No. This is a prototype modeler's garden. And everything about it has to be just so. My wife's very particular. It's why the garden looks like it does. But good Lord, it's a lot of work, So I think she got religion over the whole thing, and is definitely not of a mind to do anything like that again anytime soon. We figure the mulch is like an every 5 year kind of a thing.
Yeah, we Tina gets I think it's about 6 yards. Every spring, and it's a project, and it's almost like you can't wait for spring, and then you think, oh, I gotta have to shovel that mulch. That's not the most fun, but
Well, in this case, you couldn't do the mulch until you did the weeding, and you couldn't do the weeding until you did the fertilizing. You couldn't do this until you did that. So it all kind of hinged on all of these prerequisites that were only up to her. And we had a lot of company in the month of July, and we had a late, like a rainy start to the spring. So she almost lost like a whole month. And we just never caught up. You know what I mean? We were just behind the eight ball the entire time. So if you saw Karen, she's kind of worn out. And I basically took over the last of the mulch project and said, this is getting done.
Yeah, that's well.
So it's been a very physical month, and I guess the old guy can still kind of do it. Eventually, I mean, really, when you think about it, I've been working on all of this stuff like this at every opportunity since May. And by the time I got to the end of July, I finally felt like I was getting into shape. Like I might be tired and I might be a little sore like I did something, but I wasn't devastated, So it was kind of good to get to that stage. Thing is, it's going to be difficult to maintain it because there's no way I'm going to keep it up.
Yeah, I bet you're sleeping well at night, though.
Oh man, if it takes me 30 seconds to fall asleep, I'd be surprised.
Yep, I understand. So I'm guessing then that the layout hasn't seen much attention in that time.
No, I had my obsession at the end of July there, and I'm tentatively planning one towards the end of September, because I think that's going to be the last one before House Kaboom.
Houseable. Well, okay. So,
So that might be an interesting segue.
yeah. So that sounds like you've made some progress, at least on the architectural front.
Yes and no. The guy I have doing the architecture is your typical good guy that has 90 projects and he should only have 40, and like anybody good, he is running from one squeak, putting a little oil in that wheel, and then going to the next squeak. And I get it, but that doesn't help me, you know what I mean? So I think I was probably being a little too understanding in the beginning, but as I started to see the summer start to go by the wayside, the panic kind of set in, and I decided it was time to start leaning on him. And my wife just said, why don't you just get somebody else? And I said, look, I've got too much invested into this right now. If I'm gonna get somebody else that's good, they're gonna be busy too, and I'll be starting from scratch. And it's out of the frying pan and into the fire. I wasn't prepared to do that. So I did my project manager thing and started leaning on him in a way that he couldn't get mad at me for, but couldn't ignore. It is a little bit of an art, and that's why they say project management is an art rather than a science. So at the very beginning of September, or actually I guess it was the end of August, I got the idea of calling the town to see what the meeting schedule was, because as you know, this thing's being done in the wetlands, so you basically have to get some certain kinds of permissions in order to actually do the building. So I couldn't do that without a plan, but then I thought about it and I thought, well, we know what the footprint is going to be, and that's really all conservation cares about. They don't care if the architect hasn't figured out how to do the roof yet. So I looked at the meeting schedule and I thought, okay, we can use this as a bit of a lever. So I got the meeting schedule on a Tuesday, and I called up my architect and said, look, if I can get this in by Thursday at noon, I cannot waste weeks here. I can get this thing happening while you're finishing up figuring out how to do the roof. And he got that, and he said, all right, I can do that for you. And he did. So 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm at his office in downtown New Bedford picking up the plans and zipped over to the town hall to turn them in. And I had expected I was going to have to get what's called an order of conditions, where you go before, the Conservation Commission, and they go over the whole thing with a fine-tooth comb, and you sit there and bite your fingernails, and then they tell you if you can do it, and if so, what you have to do as part of the project to make it amenable to them. And I've been through this before with the house and with the office building, so I mean, I kind of knew what to expect. But the first thing I had done for this was to go down and talk to conservation first. And I told them what I was doing. They told me to get the survey, which I got done. And then, it's good to loop these folks in up front, as I learned. So when I went down there to turn in the plans, the girl I was talking to said, you might not need an order of conditions on this. You might need only what's called a notice of intent. And I said, keep talking. I like the sound of that. So she said, let me go get the boss. So she goes in the back to get the boss, and it's the guy I spoke with originally. So he came out and he said, show me what you're doing again here. And we already had the survey by that time, so we had something substantive to actually look at. And he looked at it, and I said, I'm just connecting here to here on an existing paved area. So he said, you know what? He says, you don't need a notice of intent for this. I mean, you don't need an order of conditions. Just do a notice of intent. Still has to go before the Conservation Commission. They will look to me for a ruling on this, and I'm telling you now, I am going to approve this. So you're basically good to go. We still have to have the meeting and all of that, but you don't need to worry. So at that point, I realized, whoa, this is actually going to happen.
That's a good thing, right?
I hope so. You always get a little bit of cold feet when you get ready to pull the trigger, but in for a penny, in for a pound, and maybe the shed remodel was a good get your feet wet on all of this, because I did bring some guys in to do the roof. I decided I might be too old to do the roof, and I think I was right.
You've got a fairly tall house. I'm not sure I'd want to be up on that roof.
Well, when I say roof, I mean on the tractor shed. It's not that tall, but boy, doing a roof is just bulwark. Shingles are really heavy,
Yes, they are.
and then just going. Yeah, it would have taken me like a week to do that roof, and they did it literally in a day.
Well,
There's a lot to be said for that.
you're right. You're right.
Gotta pick my spots. I do the stuff that I think. That where the finesse can really make a difference, and I think that's moving forward, that's the way I need to look at it. It's more about why I would be doing it rather than just, well, if I can do it, I'll save a couple of dollars. It's in the grand scheme of things, if you save a couple of dollars and you give yourself a heart attack, it's probably not worth it.
Well, and what's your time worth? Right?
My time's worth a lot to me.
I know it is. You're someone who is very guarded of your time and especially your free time. So, to do something like that, you're probably saving money to have someone else do it because they're going to do it faster and you're right. They're not going to hurt themselves, and if they do, it's not you.
In this upcoming project, I think there's probably plenty of opportunities for me to do things that are, like I say, finesse related that you don't necessarily want the contractor to do. I want them, subcontracting the concrete work, and I want them putting up the shell and doing the roof and putting in windows and doors. But there's just countless small things that are going to need to be done during the course of all of this that I'm going to simply handle myself.
Yeah, well, that's understandable and completely sane of you.
So that was the other thing was I was looking at this tractor shed project, and it was getting a little too close to September, and Karen and I really would like to take September just for us because we feel like we haven't really had much of a summer so far. So
Yeah.
I didn't want this thing leaking into September because in October it's going to start all over again, except big time.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's encouraging. I've been there, done that with the architects. I know how slow they move. It's definitely a squeaky wheel kind of thing. When I built the addition onto my house, the architect said, "Oh, it'll be about 3 weeks."
Right.
And I was I fooled me once, right? So 3 weeks went by and I called, and I don't believe the guy had even turned on his computer at that point.
Right.
And then I got to be a pain in the neck because we were dealing with an entire addition that was roughly about 1500 square feet, and this was August, and we needed to get it construction going and everything weather tight by December.
That's everybody's goal, and that's the other thing to keep in mind. I was in this guy's office picking up my plans, and there was another guy standing there who had gotten there before me who was basically having the same conversation. So it's sometimes you have to manage expectations, and that's an art too. And if you are telling people, it's better to, how does the expression go? It is better to under promise and over deliver rather than the reverse, right?
Sure.
And I don't know that everybody knows how to do that right, based on my experiences with providers in general. You see the reverse of that too much.
Well, I think it's a forgotten axiom. Or nobody cares. I'm not sure which, but it's very seldom when that actually pans out the way it's supposed to.
Well, I find anytime I'm managing customer expectations that to so that the so that what's going to happen closely resembles actual reality, I'm always happier, they're always happier. It just works better. You think that would be obvious once you've been in business for a while.
Well, and then and just to relate it to what I do, I was talking to someone that I work with about this the other day, and it's called the truth. And again, it's a little used axiom anymore, but I would rather be truthful with a client and say, "Look, I know you need this in 5 weeks, but it's going to take 10."
Yeah, I know. I used to tell customers, I understand what you'd like to have happen, but unfortunately, I have to deal with what's actually possible.
And usually when we get to the point where they need it in 5, but they can't get it until 10, it's because they did something to delay it.
Sure.
But that becomes all clouded. So, I'm at an age where I'm perfectly comfortable sitting down and saying, "Look, this is what it is." And I find that
And if
at
you can
the
back that up with, and here's why,
yep.
anybody that's reasonable will accept that.
Yep. I find that almost 100% of the time, the issue goes away.
Yep.
Not only does it go away, but because I haven't lied to them, it doesn't become a bigger issue at the 5 week mark when they don't get what they think they were going to get.
Well, it actually kind of builds trust over time, which is just invaluable.
But having said all that, you did actually attend an op session.
I did, yeah. And I will leave out whose obsession it was. You can guess, but I'm not going to confirm. Don't throw out any names.
Well, I already know.
Okay. But I'm not mentioning any names, as I said, because
Okay.
I think the guy wouldn't bother me, but I know it bothered him. We had the first failed op session ever.
Really?
And it was a hardware failure. Basically, his system quit right after lunch.
No kidding.
Yep. And of course, on a long enough timeline, this happens to everybody, right? So, and it's everybody's biggest fear when you put on an op session and people are traveling in many cases from long distances. The last thing you want to do is have them get there and your layout is down. Now, you might recall that I had spoken about at my last op session when I went to turn the everybody's there. I go to flip the switch on the layout and the system won't run. And it was because I had too many engines in that on that booster. I think we spoke about that a little bit.
Yep.
So I've got a brand new booster sitting there waiting to be installed, in fact, just for that reason. So I think in his case, what ended up happening was it was a 10-year-old system. It had actually been repaired once by the manufacturer because he had had a lightning strike and components had needed to be replaced, and it had worked fine after that. But you can't tell me that a repaired lightning damage system is as good as new. I'll never believe that. This technological stuff barely works under ideal circumstances. So can you tell I'm in the computer business? So it ended up being for everybody but the layout owner, it actually was not a bad time because we all kind of buckled down and got together and worked cooperatively on the debug, because it wasn't initially clear what was happening. And you solve for X and there was a Y and a Z in this equation. And in fact, I found two cabooses that had wheel sets, like out of the four wheel sets on the cabooses, at least two on each of these two cabooses was showing 5 ohms across. So
Oh,
it was almost a short, but not quite a short. So I suspect that may have been a contributing factor in damaging the system, because it wasn't enough to cause the breakers to trip, but it was clearly an excessive load on the system. So it was actually a good bonding event, and I think everybody but the layout owner had a good time.
yeah.
And we said all the right things, and I think even the next day he was feeling better about it. But it is it kind of makes you think about it. Like, how many people host op sessions with several people where they're traveling from distances and even consider the fact of having a spare, NCE or Digitrax unit or whatever they're using?
Right.
Almost nobody has a spare main unit.
No, because they're expensive and they don't want to, they don't think about what could happen. And even if they did, they probably wouldn't want to spend the money. But
I'm gonna have to ask my friend Ken McCrory if he has an extra main unit, because if anybody does, it's got to be him.
he's probably got redundancy on redundancy.
He probably has a shelf full of them just for that reason.
They're next to the bag of ballast under the layout.
Right.
You brought up a good point, Mike, and I think that you're right. No, who would think of it? But obviously, it's nothing more than a fairly unsophisticated computer. Who knows where they're made and who's making them?
It will
So,
not last forever, no matter how good it is. Nothing does.
what's the quality control in an item like that?
And electronic things like that are, they work and then they don't. There's not usually any advance warning, really.
Right. And then lastly, it would just make sense that if you're geared towards a prototypically operating layout, then you should have backup.
I always preach redundancy in the IT world because I see how these things fail. And I mean, your hobby is a little different. You know, it's not a business. Nobody dies if your system fails. You don't lose money per se. You might be a little embarrassed or somebody might be a little inconvenienced, but that's really the sum total of it. On the other hand, if you just don't want to ever be in that scenario, the only thing that will suffice is to have a backup tested system on the shelf, ready to plug in if you need it.
Yeah, you
I
know,
just
and
I
I.
just wonder how often this has happened to anybody else. This is a layout that's been used quite frequently over 10 years, and really the system has given excellent service. So, begs the question, what's the useful life of these things? I really don't know.
Well, does anybody? Because, you know, isn't it ours?
Possibly, but it might also be load. I mean, we're running increasing numbers of sound equipped engines these days. And when I was talking with LokeSound, they said when you're figuring your loco count per district, also add in for the power packs, which I hadn't been thinking about. So if you start doing that, you get beyond the magical threshold there pretty easily. So when I called Ken and he told me he has a booster for every yard or staging yard, I just thought, yeah, that's obviously the right way to do it.
Well, again, let me put my surprised look on.
Yeah, well, that's why I ask him for advice on a lot of issues, because chances are, if it's going to be if you're going to run into something, chances are already run into it and solved it and has the solution. So why reinvent the wheel?
Sure, makes sense. And speaking of spinning wheels, it's hurricane season.
Yes, in fact, right before I got on with you, I was on the phone with my son who lives in Naples, Florida, and he's taking it seriously down there. I mean, Jay's 32, and I'm still used to his youthful approach of, I'm not too worried about it. I used to tell him, boy, buddy, you are never going to die of stress. But the ante's different. He's got a business and he's got an inventory, and he's concerned about that. He's concerned about his household, and mercifully, he's doing all the right things, and also consulting with me on some things. So, although Karen's very worried for him too, I think he's doing everything that you can do at this point. So, it's just a matter of riding it out. I hope it's more of a an inconvenience than a giant problem. But needless to say, I'll probably have a much bigger than normal vested interest in watching this hurricane from afar.
Sure, and still all sorts of forecasting models that don't exactly show it's what exactly that path is going to be, but right over Naples, Florida is one of them.
Absolutely, and they're saying that with this particular storm, winds on the eye wall are equivalent to a pretty good tornado. So that's nothing to fool around with,
No, it
so.
isn't, and a tornado moves a hurricane moves a hell of a lot slower than a tornado does.
Yep, you can maybe get out of the way of a tornado with enough advance warning, but basically the entire peninsula of Florida is under the gun here. So our thoughts go out to everybody down there, and hopefully it'll just be a big storm.
Well, as well as the folks in Texas and Louisiana who, just had to deal with it and certainly were devastated by it. So it's a tough time of year if you live in those places. And even us up here, Mike, I mean, we tend to get, by the time they reach us, they tend to have lost a lot of their luster. But we've still had and historically have had some pretty severe storms come through here.
We haven't had a major one here since Bob, and that was probably, in the high 20s of years ago. But have you ever been to Paednaran, South Dartmouth?
No.
There's a causeway that goes across the harbor. It's a decent length causeway. It might be, half a mile or something like that. After Hurricane Bob, the entire causeway had easily 100 boats on top of it. Like
Jeez.
somebody had placed them there one after another. The storm surge just came in. All the boats that were sheltering in the inner harbor, well, they didn't get scuttled. They got placed on the causeway. It took about a week to open the road just because they had to methodically go in there with a crane and remove these boats one by one. It very unusual sight, to say the least. Now, the models so far, none of them show the likelihood of this particular storm zipping up the East Coast and being a direct threat here. I was concerned because, now that I'm going to like do an addition, it's probably perfect timing for an active hurricane season here,
Sure, why not?
it's like the opposite psychology to, snowfall this winter now that I have a giant tractor to take care of it.
Well, hopefully September will be a little calmer for you.
Let's hope so.
Or at least not as physically.
I've got my conservation meeting in a little over a week, and hopefully that will just be a non-event, and we will just move on from there. And if that's the case, there should be a lot more to talk about next month.
Awesome. Well, look forward to it.
So you've been traveling, haven't you?
It's been a crazy year, but it just feels like a lot of it's been concentrated in the last 30 days or so before we broke parted company in the last podcast. We talked a little bit about my upcoming trip to the Azores, which has since come and gone. And it was a great trip. It was so much fun. So many people have no idea where the Azores are. I can't tell you. I would explain it to people at work, and they say, "Well, isn't that down in the Caribbean?" One person thought it was out in the Pacific, and finally, I pulled it up on the internet and showed them, and every single person, who didn't have ancestors from the Azores, and of course, in our neck of the woods, Mike, there are quite a few that do.
Yeah, it's one sitting right here. I think it's me.
We're all quite surprised that it's kind of in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, I had always pictured it growing up to be more like, Nantucket is to Massachusetts, but it's not. It's not.
No, it isn't. It's about 1,000 miles west of Portugal.
I mean, that's a lot.
It is a lot. It's about two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic Ocean from here.
Makes for a
And
decent flight for at least, right?
well, so no. So here's the thing. It's a 4.5 hour flight from Boston.
Right.
It's an easy flight. Coming back is a different story because you're flying into the headwinds, and it actually took us 6 hours to get home, which was a little bit of a drag.
Wow.
And then So and you know to kind of and I'm going in no particular order here, but Europeans in general and Portuguese are no exception, don't always adhere to the hands on a clock. So if a flight is scheduled to leave at 3, it may not actually leave until 4, and nobody really gets in a twist about it.
Huh.
So we were about an hour or so late taking off for no apparent reason. And then it was a 6 hour flight on top of that. But
I have to say that the pictures that you had posted from your trip were really impressive. Like, we did not expect that. They were stunning, to be honest with you.
I'm a really great photographer for one thing, but that was a joke, Michael. Please laugh when I make a joke. I can
Well, I
get.
mean, I was about to challenge that as being a joke because clearly you're pretty good because those pictures were really good.
Well, it's difficult to take a bad picture in there because it's a very mountainous, volcanic, scenic environment. There's a lot of open mountainside pastures. There's lakes that have formed in volcanic craters.
It looked very unspoiled in the pictures.
Well, it is. There's really, other than in the city in Ponta Delgada, which is the largest city in San Miguel, which is the largest island in the archipelago, there really isn't a lot. There's this city, which is about 44,000 people, I think they said. And it's a typical European city. You would think you were on mainland Europe and that the roads are very narrow, the architecture is very typical. You have the small cars and the motor bikes riding around. Everybody smokes. So
Europe in general is like that. That surprised
yeah,
me too when I went there.
it's a
People were like smoking inside at a restaurant, and I
yeah,
thought,
nobody got the memo
is
there.
that okay?
Are they allowed to do that? Ponta Delgado as a city was really cool. While we were there, they had this festival that kind of celebrates the end of summer, even though it was only the beginning of August. And everybody wears white from head to toe. And it went from,
Had
I
you
think it
packed
was,
accordingly?
no, we had no idea. So, and we didn't go anyway because, first of all, we were dead tired from doing everything else that we were doing on that trip. But, I said to Tina, I said, as much as it might be nice to kind of dive headfirst into the Azorean culture, I'd be a little concerned because we just don't know how these people behave. And it appeared that it was this gigantic outdoor festival, which is exactly what it was. But it started at 7 o'clock at night and it didn't end until 4 in the morning.
Really?
So you can only imagine the condition of some of those people at 4 in the morning. It's the mountains are beautiful. Once you get out of the city, the vistas are just incredible. You can see there are many spots in the island where you can see, both the east and west side of the island and the ocean on both sides.
Oh, wow.
We did some hiking. We went on a whale watch, unfortunately, on a day where all the whales were being kept underwater.
I'm not convinced you ate a sufficient quantity of seafood, though, based on the pictures I saw.
There was almost no seafood. So, and here's the thing.
Get out.
Okay, bye. They're actually best known for their cattle. Everywhere you go, like all those open fields that you saw,
Yes.
that's for cattle grazing. So it's much easier to find a piece of steak.
Really?
Yeah. Now,
My
fishing
people
is
are known for overcooking steak, by the way.
certainly an industry there. I'll tell you, I had a couple of great steaks
Did
there.
you?
No, fishing is certainly an industry. Dairy and cattle are huge there. They actually one of their industries or one of their cottage industries is this particular cheese that they import all over Europe. And I guess it's, feel like cheese, it's very good, but
It wasn't goat cheese.
no, they were cows. It was
So,
bovine-ish.
they did not have goats.
I didn't see a goat,
Interesting. That might be more of a mainland thing.
but there were cows. There were
Fair enough.
definitely cows. So one of the reasons for the trip was that, as we talked about last time, Tina's father's family comes from the Azores, and we've done some ancestry.com stuff to try to get a sense of the lineage and how far back we could go, and it's a difficult process.
Does she speak the language?
She does not.
Okay.
She does not, and the prime reason that she does not is because she was raised on army bases. So, you know, even though her father is Portuguese, there was a disconnect with his parents who did speak the language.
My parents used it as a secret language to talk about stuff they didn't want me to know about.
So you don't know, you don't speak it either
Not really. Nope.
then. Well, basically everybody in the Azores speaks English.
Okay.
In fact, we were talking to someone and they said, yeah, it's a requirement in the schools.
So you had no issues.
So we had no issues whatsoever. So we wanted to see if we could find her great great grandparents, who died in the late 1800s. So we found the town that they were from, and actually the first day we were there, we went to the cemetery in Ponta Delgada, and there were some peculiarities that we saw there that you don't see here.
Like,
Well, let's call it the undead.
oh, come on.
No, I'm only kidding. There's no undead. Kind of like, you know, because it's an island, because of the climate, most people are buried above ground.
I see.
So there are a lot of
Mausoleums.
Mausoleums, and wood is a no-no there, because it's a, even though it's not, that you wouldn't consider the temperatures tropical, it's considered a tropical climate because the range of temperatures never varies between, like, say, 60 and 78 degrees,
Really?
and it's always very humid there. In fact, it's the only place in Europe where they grow tea and pineapples.
Wow.
Yeah, but it never gets above 78.
Sounds like a pretty ideal climate if you ask me.
Well, it's also very rainy there.
Okay.
It rains just about every day, to one degree or another. So people, most people are buried in these mausoleums, and the doors to the mausoleum are aluminum. Everything is aluminum framed over there. If it's metal, it's aluminum because it doesn't rust. Glass doors. So you can look in these mausoleums and you can see, you know, four or five caskets in there. But then there was this other box, if you will. I thought it was for cremated remains because it was small. Fast forward to us finding the cemetery in the town where her great great grandparents lived and we assumed were buried. And the town is actually, as fate would have it, literally right next to Ponta Delgado. Right next to the airport and right next to Ponta Delgado. So we went to the cemetery on a Sunday,
Did you
and
guys rent a car or were you at
we
what?
rented a car,
Okay.
yeah. The cemetery was closed and locked up. And I thought, all right, well, you know, I can, you know, over here, like, they might put a chain across the gate or something so you can't drive in, but no one's going to really care if you want to walk in. But you couldn't even do that
Wow, it's because of the undead.
because of the undead.
Right.
So we came back the following day, which was Monday, which was the day we were leaving, so we were kind of under the gun to get this all in.
Right.
And so we walked through the whole cemetery, and we couldn't find, not only couldn't we find her great grandparents, but what we did find was that there was not a grave marker that was older than 1972. And so we started to think,
So you
well,
had the wrong cemetery.
are we in the wrong cemetery? What's going on here? There's no one to talk to. You know, we're on Google Maps. We can't find anything that looks like another cemetery. So we kind of, there was a, you know, we're kind of discouraged. I got on the plane and came home.
So you obviously have to go back.
Well, so here's what I found out. I get to work the next day, and I'm telling, you know, the story of my Azores trip to someone at work, and I said, you know, Lee in accounts payable, she's from the Azores. And I said, oh, really? I said, you know, I don't know her, to introduce myself, but I just, you know, strike up a conversation and see if she has, you know, any insight. So we were talking at lunch, and I brought up this whole issue with the cemetery. And she kind of looked at me funny. And
Which you're used to.
which I, yeah, but this was even a different funny from that. From that, I'm about to call the police on you. So she said, well, she said, do you want me to explain to you how it works over there? I said, by all means, yeah.
Hell yes.
She said, that is the only cemetery. She said, cemetery real estate is a premium there because it's an island.
Okay.
She said, so here's what happens. She said, a lot of the people that are buried and that aren't in mausoleums, it's not actually their final resting place.
Huh.
I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, so if you were looking for your girlfriend's great great grandparents, there's a good chance that at one time they were buried in that cemetery.
Okay.
And I said, so what happened? And she said, well, she said, did you see a sign for an ossuary? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. She said, do you know what that is? I said, well, what I know an ossuary to be is a box where if someone discovered ancient bones, they would dig, put them in this box called an ossuary and seal it up. And she said, yes. She said, it's a bone box. The translation is li literally bone box. And she said, so what happens in the Azores is that when you die, you get buried. And let's say 20 years later, Karen dies, and you get dug up. Your bones get thrown in an ossuary. Karen gets tossed in the grave, and the box gets put on top of the grave, which explains all these little boxes we saw sitting on the ground. So she said some of the bigger cemeteries have more of a general ossuary where, a lot of these bone boxes are placed. And she said at that particular cemetery, they probably have one, and that's where, the great great grandparents are. And I said, well, would it be marked? And she said, probably not.
Jeez.
She said, you can, however, nowadays pay to not be dug up.
So
So,
instead of renting the spot where you'll be resting, you can actually own it.
right. So the interesting thing was that so I
Sheesh.
had mentioned a couple of things to Tina that until I had talked to this woman, just never, I couldn't put the pieces together because to even think of doing something like that over here is just, you would never think of it. The first was that a lot of the graves were bordered by like decorative borders on the ground that looked like they were really, really, really old, much older than the date of the inscription on the tombstone. So I found that to be odd. I couldn't piece that together. The other thing was that while we were walking through the cemetery, there was a grave. Someone had dug up a grave. And there was just a big hole in the ground, and the shovel was actually there. But this grave was in literally the middle of the cemetery. And when I tell you, it's not like if you walked through the Catholic cemetery in Dartmouth, there's room to move around.
Sure.
In this cemetery, literally the graves are touching each other. There's no room to walk between the headstones. You can't even, they have walkways, like sidewalks that kind of snake their way throughout the cemetery, but there's no grass or anything like that.
Really?
No, not at all. It's dense pack.
Did you take pictures of all that? I don't remember seeing this.
Yeah, I think there were. I may not have posted them. But maybe I'll post it on the podcast group just so people can see what I'm talking about. But it was eerie, and the explanation was equally eerie. But it made sense, and the unfortunate part of it is that if we ever did go back, the likelihood of us still ever finding what we were looking for wouldn't be good.
Well, it's even, I think, maybe even more beneficial just to be able to, picture walking around on the same street they were walking around on, that kind of thing.
Well, and it's such a neat place. The whole, I mean, we were only on one of the nine islands, but
So, would you go back?
yeah, I would go back. I would go back. We kind of did, everything that a tourist would do there.
So
And it's not,
you'd go to a different island.
we might go to a different island. It's not a particularly touristy place.
I like the sound of that.
And I think they're kind of to the degree that they can, because it's an island, and there's only so many places you can build. They're trying to gear up more for tourists. But for instance, the hotel that we stayed in was probably the newest. Well, I know it was the newest, but and I'm sure it was probably the most expensive hotel on the island.
It's just how you roll.
Well, it is what it is. But to the left of the hotel was this abandoned, I guess at one time it must have been an office building, but it was, three stories or so tall, and it was just completely gutted except the concrete and steel. And so there were no walls on it, and it was all cordoned off with a chain link fence, and it was overgrown with weeds. And that was directly to the left of the hotel. On the right, directly to the right of the hotel, was it a much prettier scene. It was the island prison. And literally from the window in the hallway outside of our room, you could look into the prison courtyard and see them playing basketball.
Wow. So, did you have a word with TripAdvisor when you got back?
I didn't, because I think other, I mean, it didn't detract. The everything that we did was so cool. We went to this volcanic crater, a caldera, where these two lakes have formed, and that was kind of the seminal picture in the bunch. Mike, you may remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called Sete Cidades, which, and I know that's kind of a Spanish pronunciation, but it means basically two lakes. And the road that leads to it inevitably places you about 1,500 feet above the crater.
Okay.
And on top of this mountain is this abandoned hotel, and it was abandoned because it's just so far out in the middle of nowhere that people would go there, but there was nothing else to do
Yep.
and difficult to get anywhere to do it. But and it wasn't an old hotel, but it had been abandoned for about 5 or 6 years, and literally Mother Nature had just taken the whole thing back. It was completely overgrown with vines. It was kind of creepy, but from that vantage point, you could take all these incredible photographs. And the amazing thing is that the volcano last erupted about 400 years ago. And there is a whole town down there that lives in this crater. And we did some hiking around the lake, and you can see the
You mean
I
right
don't.
now there's a town there?
Oh yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, there's probably about, I don't know, hundreds of houses down there. We actually ate lunch down there at a little restaurant we found. But in our hike, and I don't know the exact geological term, but the stratified embankments that around the area we were hiking, you could see where there was a volcanic eruption, and you could see all the lava and pumice from that, and then you could see, a period where there was just soil. And then another eruption, and then soil, and then another. And that went on for maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 different cycles. that you could clearly see in the side of this embankment. And they say it's dormant, but it's not extinct.
Right.
So it could go off again.
Well, that town will be the first to know.
Yeah, well, they might not actually. They might not know what hit them. So anyway, just moving on from that, and I do recommend it, but got back, had an opportunity to get up to Dick Elwell's house a couple of weekends ago and play a round of golf to celebrate his 82nd birthday,
Wow.
and shoot some pictures of the part of the layout that will be represented in this article that I'm working on. So and what I found, and I knew this, but I was just kind of hoping that I could kind of circumvent it. So I need to invest in a high quality tripod, because the cheapo ones that are out there, and I bought a less expensive one because I hardly ever use one.
Yeah, my photography buddy gave me for helping him build his house this incredible tripod, and it's a Manfrotto, I think, and we call it the man's tripod because it's just so heavy duty, it's ridiculous.
Well, like I said, I need to invest because, when you're taking a 2 second long photograph,
Right.
the tripod better be steady.
Right.
So I was literally able to get one photograph of each of the areas that I photographed to come out without being shaky.
Really?
Yeah. So I was particularly disappointed. So I'm gonna, in a short amount of time, I'm gonna head back up there and with a better tripod and do it again. But
If you need to borrow my tripod,
well, I appreciate the
long
offer,
as
and
you
I
promise to give it back.
well, obviously, but I may take you up on that. Except that I also know that I do need to invest in one. So that was the month. Oh,
Wow.
it so it wasn't the month, right? The month didn't end there.
No.
So as part of the whole, I mentioned it was kind of a busy year. We went to New Mexico in April, and so Tina said, we've been to gone from New Mexico to the Azores in the span of a few months. But we actually went away over the weekend too, down to a resort and spa down in Plymouth, and played some golf Saturday in perfect weather. So it was, we just don't get away enough, Mike.
Yeah, no, you it sounds like you got some probably much needed R&R. This is a good thing.
Well, it is. Work has been crazy. I love it, but it is. It's beaten me up a little bit, and there's a lot of 6 a.m. mornings in the office.
Right.
And as you know, tonight I walked in the door about 7. So long days, but in any case, that's our very, very sparse model railroad related podcast this month.
Well, I thought you had something to talk about vis-a-vis Steamtown.
Oh, yes, I do. All right, so let's get real with this then.
Okay.
So, you had mentioned that you had been to, one of the previous incarnations of Steamtown, and
No. I said I'd never been to the previous one. I've been to the current one.
oh, the current one. Okay, so for folks who don't know, Steamtown is a National Historic Site in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but it took a lot to kind of get to that point in its history. It was actually founded by a gentleman by the name of Ellis Atwood, who was the founder of Edenville Railroad, which is now owned by John Della Priscoli, who is also now the owner of the Grafton and Upton Railroad. So talk about a small world,
Right.
right? So Steamtown started out in Edenville, which is in Carver, Massachusetts. It moved to North Walpole, New Hampshire, which is where Ellis Atwood actually lived and died in a plane crash. And then it moved across the river to Bellows Falls, Vermont, and then in the mid-80s, it moved down to Scranton, Pennsylvania, where it was taken over by the federal government. And unlike a lot of things that are taken over by the federal government, this actually flourished.
Okay.
And it's an incredible facility down there. They do great work. And you know, anybody who's interested in the history of railroads and the preservation of steam locomotives kind of really owes it to themselves to go there and kind of see this collection.
And just the facility itself is historic.
Well, so in the facility, it was the old Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad Yard in Scranton, which was an incredibly busy hub. And actually, from a prototype railroad standpoint, has become so again over the past 10 years or so. But it doesn't mean, as much as I appreciate what they do, it doesn't mean I don't have my bones to pick with them too. And today was a case. One of the locomotives in their collection is a former Boston and Maine Pacific. It's commonly referred to as 3713.
I think I saw that when we were down there for the Loc Sound tour, and they, you know, the guy that was giving the tour was talking about the various projects and what stages they were in. And that unit you're talking about was there like a bundle of parts, basically.
Yeah. So the locomotive, just to give you a little background, it was one of the last steam locomotives operated by the Boston and Maine. It ran out of North Station in commuter passenger service for many, many years. And it was retired, and somehow it ended up, and I don't know how it got there other than, you know, you probably could have ran a track to it. It ended up alongside the Museum of Science in Boston, where it sat outside for a number of years. And I remember going there in grade school on a field trip, and you could actually climb up on it and literally sit on the boiler. So somehow it made its way from the Museum of Science into Steamtown's collection. And someone decided that the two or three, two and a half steam locomotives that they had operating really needed to be augmented with another one, and that this was the most likely candidate. So they, back about 1991 or two, they decided to restore it.
Okay.
And the discussion was, or the prediction was, it would take 2 years. Well, first it was 2 years, then it was 5 years, and you know, then it was another 5 years. Well, it's 2017. And that locomotive is still, it's still a kit in the back shop.
Do we know what specifically is holding it up? Is it lack of expertise?
Well, it's my understanding is, and I had a back shop tour back about 2008 or 9. And at the time, all of the parts that they needed to rebuild Humpty Dumpty were there in boxes or crates in the back shop.
Okay.
The issue was the time to do the work, because it's an all-volunteer staff.
Right.
And the ability to do the work. The one of the gentlemen who was, and he may still be responsible for this project, a gentleman by the name of Carl Packer, told me that the people who had the boiler expertise are dead or dying quickly. And the people who are filled with good intentions and want to get this thing up and running are learning as they go along. And it's a very, very slow process. But, you know, like after a while, and, you know, to me, you know, 20, going on 27 years is a long time. You start to lose faith that this thing is ever going to run again. So what kind of prompted my ire today was, and this is a periodic thing on the Steamtown Forum on Facebook, which I'm a member of, was a gentleman had written in and said, what do you think the next locomotive, that they'll try to restore will be after they're done with the Boston and Maine 3713?
Which, if you know anything about what's going on, is a pretty silly thing to ask.
Yeah, I mean, it's just honestly,
He didn't know.
he had no idea. But you've got all these people who they're looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. And I hate to be Debbie Downer, but this thing's just never going to run. It just isn't. There isn't enough time left as a planet to get this thing going at this point. But there was a lengthy discussion. I would say probably well over 100 posts. About the state of this thing and everybody's prediction about what should be next, and it is an extensive collection. And in theory, they could pick something else. They did an analysis a few years ago, and the locomotive they said was most likely to have a successful restoration was the nickel plate Berkshire that's down there.
It just needs less work.
And these, well, it's in better condition, but having said that, and that locomotive actually was had run the shortest time ago. But when I was down there, it had holes in its cylinders big enough to stick your head in. It's just, I think this is just a case of so many people are good intentioned and enthusiastic, and but they have no idea what they're getting themselves into. I mean, just the boiler inspection that's required nowadays.
Right, well, the rules just keep getting tougher.
Well, they had the Pennsylvania K4 Pacific that was on display at Horseshoe Curve in there. And I don't know whether it was the state of Pennsylvania or who it was that was going to have Steamtown restore this thing. And quite frankly, if I had a steam locomotive that I was going to restore, I wouldn't send it to Steamtown. I'd send it down to Strasburg and let them do it because they're professionals. But my understanding is, and if I have the story wrong, I apologize, but my understanding based on the information that was passed along for me from the same gentleman, Carl Packer, was that they rebuilt the crown sheet, which is a significantly important part of the boiler because it's the part where it's kind of the balance between the fire and the firebox and the water level. And it keeps the locomotive from blowing up. They had built it to the specifications of a bygone era. And when they came in, when the inspectors came in to inspect it, it didn't even closely pass. Wasn't even close to passing. And at that point, they basically said, "Well, we're out of money." And
You mean they didn't budget to do it twice?
they didn't budget to do it twice, no. So, unless someone else is currently working on this that I'm not aware of, it's not ever going to be restored.
Wow. So
So
did you step in with a reality check or just watch all of this discussion?
well, I think you know me well enough. And I did. And so I said, look, based on, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't find my actual post here, but I said, look, I said, this has been going on for over 20 years, almost 30 years, really. And I said, I wouldn't hold my breath. I said, I'd love to see this thing run. And I would. And guys like Jim Corcoran. I mean, I've donated money to the project. There was for years and years, there was a booth at the Springfield show. And I used to donate money, but I also helped Jim in a campaign that he kind of kicked off to get some tender wheels for it. That kind of fell flat after a lengthy process. But and then I saw what he went through in terms of literally raiding the roundhouse that used to be outside North Station for bearings and valves and shutoffs
That
and
stuff was still sitting there.
it was and some of it I guess was a little more universal in nature.
Okay.
But what he said to me was, he said it was considered an asset and they couldn't throw it away. So in this warehouse they had inside this facility, they still had steam locomotive parts.
Boy, a lot of what you're saying sounds very familiar. I must wonder if it was the same guy that gave the tour when I was down there. Wouldn't
That's
surprise me.
possible.
Yeah.
So anyway, I responded to this guy, Stephen DeVries, who wrote, probably be another decade before the Boston Main is restored. And I wrote, Stephen is probably accurate. It's been over 25 years since restoration plans and work begun on 3713. Many people have expended countless hours on a project that seems to have no end. I would love to see this locomotive run, but I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for that day. And a guy wrote in and said, open your wallet and it will happen sooner rather than later. Which forced a reply from me, but
Doesn't sound like money is the limiting factor here.
no, I don't think at this point it is either. Like I say, from what I was told, all the parts are there. And they, and they have done, probably quite a bit of work. But I just think that it's just such a daunting task.
Well, when you think about it, the number of people who actually know how to do that, I'll bet you can count them on two hands and not have many fingers left over.
Yeah, oh, I can't imagine that there's really, when you think about it, in the Northeast, the last steam trains ran in the mid-50s, and those were only in a few spots.
I mean, basically, they waited too long.
They waited too long because they're Yankees and, they're frugal and they didn't want to throw away something that still worked. But the, for instance, the Pennsylvania Railroad was one of the first railroads to dieselize.
Right.
So they got rid of their steam fleet early, as did a lot of Pennsylvania railroads. So, that area down there, they just, I mean, if you worked in a steam back shop in the 1950s, the chances of you still being alive aren't really good,
Right.
60 some odd years ago.
And it's not like there was an opportunity to pass this knowledge down in the normal apprentice type fashion once you discontinue the use of steam.
No, it died. It died. So I, I'm curious to know if any of our listeners knows more than what I just presented. Again, I've donated money. I'd love to see this locomotive run. It's a local locomotive. So it'd certainly be a little bit of pride to see, something that ran up here run again. But doesn't sound good.
Very, very interesting.
So, and if I hear anything, I'll pass it on.
Yeah, and by the same, like you said, if anybody knows anything, please chime in on the group because, information sharing, I think, is a good thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, folks, I think this wraps it up for our September podcast. Thank you very much for listening.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to toss in was, I think August was the first month where I didn't do a locomotive sound install in the whole month. And well, part of that was because I caught up on my backlog, and part of it was it seems like people just took the summer off. But you know what's funny? Right at Labor Day weekend, almost like somebody turned a key, I started hearing from people who would say, "Yep, can I send in three or four units? And I've got four or five units I'm going to be sending in to you next week." It's funny how it's feast or famine.
Well, knowing you, you'll somehow manage to find a way to get caught up by the end of the month. So,
Hey, remember my tool reorganization? I actually did two on a rush basis for a guy because he wanted me to hand them to him this past weekend. I got him on a Wednesday and got the locos to him, brought him with me on a Saturday. That would have been impossible before my tool and bench reorganization. Seriously.
well, organization is the key, right?
Absolutely.
All right, folks, thank you very much as always for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.
See you then.